Welcome to At the Organ, a weekly show about the classical organ and its music, heard on organlive.com every Sunday or streaming from our website anytime. Just point your browser to attheorgan.com for more information. Now, let's hear what's happening this week at the organ.
Hello and welcome to At the Organ. My name is Brent Johnson. Today we complete the interview from last week with Eileen Gunther, president of the American Guild of Organists and associate professor of church music at Wesley Theological Seminary. If you missed the first part of this interview from May 27th, you can find it on our website. Also, you can find links to the American Guild of Organists, Dr. Gunther's biography, and a link to pre-order her new book entitled Rivals or a Team? Clergy-Musician Relationships in the 21st Century. I started by asking her to tell us about this new book.
Mark Lawson of Morningstar invited me to write it. He'd read what I'd been writing about the importance of clergy-musician partnership, which has been a passion of mine for a very long time, as I have seen things not go well for no good reason. I mean, there are many reasons. I don't consider most of them good reasons.
What's then, in your opinion, the greatest cause of failure in these relationships?
Ego. Ego and need for control. The book is called, and we worked at the title quite a while, but it's called Rivals or a Team. And denominations approach things in a different way, and this is not about the polity. There's not a single musician I know that would say, oh, I am just as politically important within the congregation as the senior pastor is. That's not the deal. What exists for the purposes of polity and what exists for the way we operate with each other do not have the same track. And the book establishes, I hope well, the premise that we do better as a team. Better together, it's life together, the Bonhoeffer concept, and working together, getting a lot of ideas on the table, having every idea not be a good idea necessarily, but no one is criticized for it. You put it out there, you work with it, you plan worship together, the whole way a congregation works is better when there are more ideas. You can say, you know, the who wants to be a millionaire concept of, you know, the audience, and there are lots of statistics, good to great. Many books have been written about the possibilities of teams, and this I'm just applying to the church.
Are the experiences you're drawing from personal or just from other professional relationships? Where did you develop your ideas?
I probably started thinking about it when I was the point person for grievance procedures for the AGO and became aware of seriously difficult situations in churches. And the AGO has a grievance process that we're actually going to be revising. But that made me aware of problems. Of course, we have colleagues and we hear stories. The book is based on a lot of reading about leadership theory and application to the church, but then the underlying text actually is personal stories, not so much mine. I'm aware of things myself, but I've leaned on colleagues and asked them to share their stories. Part of this sharing thing happened when I was teaching a course actually for Carol, just as a substitute one night, and I said, oh, I think I'm just going to write my chapter and just put out a note saying, what would you like me to say to these clergy, future clergy? And I got some amazing responses. So I shared them with that class. And then some of them said, you know what? You need to ask us too what we would like to say to musicians. So then as I was working on the book, I thought, okay, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with this because everything takes a while to form. But so I wrote 25 or 30 clergy friends. I know lots of clergy. And said, what would you like musicians to know? So I have two chapters. One is effective musicians, and the back part of that is what the clergy wrote that they would have musicians know, and the other is effective clergy. And then the back part of that is what musicians want clergy to know. The last chapter of the book is personal reflections of musicians. And it's anywhere from what it means to me to be a church musician, which I think is important to share, to talking about individual situations, some of which have been wonderfully supportive collegial partnerships, and some situations of psychological abuse, and certainly abuse of authority. At the very least, some folks wrote and just couldn't put their name on it. Some folks just couldn't write. Revisiting some of the situations that, many musicians have been part of was so painful that they tried, and I think they wanted to be, you know, supportive of the project, but they just couldn't do it, which I find just heartbreaking.
Let's say, heaven forbid, someone's in a situation like that that's unpleasant and unhelpful. Does your book offer assistance for improving
the situation? Yes, I have strategies for team building. I have ways for dealing with conflict. I have, that sounds so egocentric. The book offers a variety of strategies. There are also, you know, I mean, let's be real. There's a chapter on what happens when a musician leaves. How do you know when it's just time to go? And strategies for transitioning and repositioning yourself and healing. Because oftentimes, if you have been really wounded, going back to the church, much less to exactly the same kind of employment situation, maybe not psychologically, but just the job, can be a very difficult prospect. And some ways to work with making that better, because what we do is what we do, not just for the money. I mean, actually, not much for the money at all in many cases, but for our love of music and our love of the church and our wanting to communicate the power of music in worship.
How can we get our hands on this book?
It should be available. Well, I think pre-order is actually already available on the Morningstar website. And I believe Mark said it would be out in about 3 weeks, certainly out in time for the AGO convention, which is very handy because he has me doing a workshop on clergy-musician relations the morning of July 5th in Nashville. So it'll be out by then. And I don't know if it'll be on Amazon or some of the other venues. But my hope is that it will be a book that maybe a team will read together. It's not just about musicians. I mean, frankly, it's about anybody who works on a church staff. There will be something that will apply to them. But to read together and talk, and there will be things that they will probably not agree with. And there will probably be things I didn't say that I could have. Every time I pick up some magazine or whatever, I think, oh, wow, I wish this had come out sooner. I could have put it in my book. But at some point, you've got to go, you know, nope, we're done.
We can always hope for a second book.
Well, or something.
Let's talk about your teaching a little bit. Tell us about the seminary where you are.
Oh, I love where I teach. It's Wesley Seminary, Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington. It is a Methodist seminary, one of 13 in the country. We have, I think, students from 32 different denominations. So it is not just Methodist. It's a wide diversity of people and a wonderful mix of not just denominations, but of ethnic backgrounds and a warm acceptance of a wide variety of music. I'm a big fan of global music. And there's just almost nothing that isn't, if it fits in the service, there's nothing that we can't do. The courses I teach are a wide variety. I do the choir and play for a chapel service and am part of two worship planning committees during the week that plan two different services. But I also teach in the classroom a hymnody course, a course in music skills, which is sort of boot camp for clergy, what you need to know as a non-musician about music. A course in Sacred Music of America. This summer, there are two courses I really enjoy teaching. One of them is Songs of Zion, which is a course on spirituals that I team teach with my colleague, Dr. William Bobby McLean, and we always have a very good time teaching that. My super favorite course, even maybe more, is Music and Social Justice, which I have started teaching, and students just basically line up. And I put a cap on the course because the room that I much prefer to teach in has a certain limitation, and we always exceed it. It's a course I've had a passion about and have really worked at preparing for quite some time and thought, okay, Eileen, quit collecting stuff, teach it. So I've prepared curriculum talking about how music makes a difference in the world. I think I finally got fed up with, oh, the music prepares us for the word. Well, yeah, it does, but it can also be the word. The music prepares us for something. Well, it has done much more than that through centuries. And I don't know that there is a protest movement or a revolution of really any sort that hasn't been accompanied or led by music. I start with spirituals, and I won't probably do this in a chronological order, and I don't always anyway, and those feed right into the music of the Civil Rights Movement, which very often were recontextualized, retexted spirituals. Abolitionist hymns and songs, social gospel from the industrial era, talk about the Holocaust and the role of the Verdi Requiem at Theresienstadt, the Defiant Requiem, that is just a fabulous story. And the quote from that piece is, "We can sing to them what we cannot say to them," which was at a time that this chorus was able to sing, perform for the Nazi hierarchy in the front row. And the Dies Irae, about having to account for yourselves, they said, you know, you all think that you're getting away with this, but you're not going to. That was the whole story behind that. It's very moving. And other music that comes from the Holocaust that gave, you know, singing saved my life. One concentration camp inmate wrote. Also talk more about anti-war music, whether it's the Vaughan Williams Dona Nobis Pacem, the Britain War Requiem, the idea of having a requiem for war. We don't want war to keep going on. Child of Our Time of Michael Tippett, other pieces of that sort, and some, of course, protest music closer to our time from the 20th century. Working through to Central and South America and all the liberation movements that happen that all have music that go with it, whether we know about it or not. I mean, you know, Oscar Romero, the martyr, and there's El Salvadorian music. I had a student last semester who's from Chile and talked about the music of his country. You can go to Korea and you talk about North and South Korea and the division there and the role of music. South Africa is a real passion of mine. I've led 6 groups to visit South Africa, groups of seminary students, and have been there a couple of other times. And the role of music in the apartheid struggle is documented in a fabulous video called A Mandala, A Revolution in Four-Part Harmony, which I think is a great title. And Tutu says, without the music, we would not be here. So that is a course I just really enjoy teaching. My other course this summer is Greatest Hits of Sacred Music. And I have canvassed my colleagues, what do you think is the best piece? And I have a, you know, group of pieces that we'll talk about. And a lot of, you know, symbolism. We'll probably do all of Messiah's. That is my plan right now, because there's so much musical symbolism in there. And you know, certainly the major Bach, the Masses, the Magnificat, the B minor Mass, Mozart Requiems, C minor Mass, and moving on through. And it's just great, great fun to share what I feel is like Christmas morning and treasures under a tree of wonderful pieces of music that are maybe known to some of the folks and they just want to get to know them better, or maybe not known at all and they develop an appreciation. They also say my classes are the most expensive ones they take. I say, how come? You know, it's the same tuition rate regardless. I said, no, we go out and buy CDs. I have people downloading iTunes during class. If they hear something they like, their, you know, account is all set up and they're ready to roll. If I have to say I have an agenda, I want them to see a church musician as a colleague. And I work with wonderful colleagues on the faculty. And the person that plans worship with me, Carol Cookmore, we are good friends. And I hope we are every step of the way modeling how clergy and musician can work together.
You're listening to At the Organ.
We're speaking with AGO President Eileen Gunther. The evening before this interview was recorded, she had presented an organ recital at First Presbyterian Church in Kirkwood, Missouri, for the St. Louis chapter of the American Guild of Organists. First Presbyterian was a church in which she took lessons as a young organist. We talked a bit about performing and playing the organ.
I guess one reason that I like to do program notes is not just because I'm had done a radio program myself for a lot of years and am used to giving commentary on the repertoire, but I like to feel a connection with the audience. And so very often, organists don't see an audience. We have a console between us, even if we're facing out. Last night, my back was to the audience. Sometimes there are rear galleries, or just it's not possible. And I'm a big believer in sort of the cyclic thing. And you know, you put out your music, but it needs reception and then comes back and energizes you in a circle. And I like to connect with the audience. So that's one of my things. Diversity, I played works of women composers last night. partially because I think women are unrepresented or underrepresented at the very least, both as recitalists and in terms of repertoire. I mean, most of the concert programs that you see will be all guys. And there are lots of fine women composers, and I think they deserve to be heard. The AGO is, maybe say 49, 51. I mean, it's right at 50% of men and women. And we work at having some kind of equality or parity, at least, in terms of performers at conventions and on boards of chapters. We can't actually dictate that, nor can we dictate the National Council. We have regions that vote for their representative, and then the people who are in the offices and counselors. So that's not, you can't engineer that, but I think it's a good thing. Most of the bigger jobs in the country are held by men, and I don't think that there is a particular reason that needs to be. I think there are tons of talented women, and I would like to just to see more of that, as well as more diversity in terms of repertoire. I mean, I played the Nigerian piece because I think there's music from around the world, and we tend to be a little Eurocentric, and I just like the idea of a broad umbrella of people, of repertoire, and of engagement in the wonderful process that is music.
Well, as I ask everybody that I talk to, what drew you to the organ specifically?
I grew up in a choir loft. My mom is a church musician, so I don't really remember not being around church, not hearing my mom play or practice, talk about choirs. She worked really hard at increasing her knowledge, going to conferences in the summer, studying with people her whole life. And she was a lifelong learner in that sense, and I know that that is part of the legacy that I've inherited. I never feel like I've, practiced enough, read enough, have prepared enough, whether it's a class I'm teaching at the seminary or a master class or a choral clinic or whatever. I just always feel like there's more to be learning all the time.
You're obviously working very, very hard with convention coming up and getting ready for summer school. What else do you do, though, when you're not playing the organ, not teaching?
Well, my husband and I like to travel. We have a daughter who is going to enter her senior year of college, and she is studying music at Lebanon Valley College in Pennsylvania, which is a small school of 1,600 students, but 200 of them are music majors. And she wants to be a high school orchestra or choral conductor is her goal. And she grew up with a fine music system in the area where we live, which is in suburban Virginia. And I hope she'll be able to land someplace that will use her fabulous talents. She's wonderful. My husband is an educator, a musician also. Had been chair of the music department at George Washington University for a number of years, thought, I want to go back to teaching. And that lasted about 6 months when he got asked to be an interim dean in the liberal arts college at GW. And he is now executive associate dean, which is just a ton of administration for, I don't know how many faculty, 700 or 800 faculty and 10,000 students, roughly. It's a big job. He has fascinating stories to bring home to dinner. We love to travel. And are always up for a neat trip together. I have been doing the South Africa trips on my own and some of the other teaching I've done in Ivory Coast and Uganda and Zimbabwe. But we have something planned for Italy fairly soon, and just look forward to that. Read when there's time, but with rehearsals and meetings and all the other kinds of things, he has receptions, and we both have an active professional life that doesn't allow us a ton of spare time.
You mentioned earlier your experience in radio. How did you get into broadcasting?
Oh, that was a lot of fun. I was invited to interview. This is for the commercial classical station in Washington, D.C., which does not now any longer, unfortunately, exist. But I did for a whole lot of years an hour-long program of organ music called The Royal Instrument, and had consistently won awards, audience awards. It had an immense appeal, and I can't say I'm surprised or disappointed, just always kind of like, okay. Not long ago, I have seen people who've sort of said, I haven't heard your show recently, but I really love it, and they say it in the present tense, which I think is completely adorable. I haven't been on the radio for quite a while, but the fact that it made that kind of impression. I did a program in Pennsylvania, and someone said, I first knew Eileen through the Royal Instrument, and I think think that's really a cool thing.
Eileen Gunther, thank you for joining us today on At the Organ. We wish you the best of luck with the upcoming convention and with your third term as president of the American Guild of Organists. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to At the Organ, a weekly look at the art and music of the classical organ. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. Send your email to info@attheorgan.com or just go to our website where you can comment on the show. There you can also hear this week's show again or find back episodes. The address is attheorgan.com. At the Organ is a production of the Organ Media Foundation. For more information about supporting the foundation or sponsoring an episode of At the Organ, go to organmedia.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll meet you here next week at the Organ.